Hi, Richard. Also, a warm welcome from my side from almost Miami, like Munich, like now with like 16 degrees currently. I think you have a bit more in Miami. I think we're all extremely curious to hear your newest insights on the creative class, on talent strategies, on the knowledge worker, and what that means to cities, and especially, of course, to German cities. I don't want to waste too much time right now, but I have to say personally that I'm extremely delighted to have our short Q&A session later on, and I hope that the topics we're going to raise are as important and thrilling for the rest of the audience as they will certainly be for me. So that's enough from my side. The floor is yours, Richard.
Thank you very much, and good morning and good day. It's an honor and a privilege for me to be with all of you at this important event. I only wish that we could be there with you in person. I think the most important thing I want to say is that it's obvious to all of us that we are in the midst of a period of fundamental economic change. Sometimes that's called the Great Recession. Other times that's called the economic crisis. And although, and with great good fortune, Germany has avoided the worst of this crisis, certainly where I am now today in the United States, in southern Florida, the economy has been literally turned upside down by this crisis, but also in Greece, in Ireland, in Spain, and in many other parts of the world, we can see the toll that a period really of wanton and rampant financial speculation, the toll that it has taken on our economy, and particularly our real economy. And I think, if anything, what this crisis represents is a fundamental shift or transformation in the nature of capitalism. And my own view on this is that this shift is as great or of similar magnitude than the shift that Karl Marx or Joseph Schumpeter or other great economists wrote about when the economy transformed from an older agrarian or feudal set system of economic and social organization to a then new system of basic mercantile trading and then industrial capitalism. And I think what this crisis really represents, when we get past the momentary shifts of the financial markets and behavior of central banks, what this crisis really represents is the transformation from an old to a new order. And what happened is that that old order simply could not contain the old social structures, the old institutional forms, the old ways we organized our companies and cities, simply couldn't contain the enormous, the tremendous, the fantastical rise of a whole new way of producing and creating wealth, value, and prosperity. It shouldn't be surprising, then, that we've encountered these turbulent and disruptive times, and the question before us, each and every one of you, each and every one of us, is looking forward, how do we distill the key elements of this new economic and social system, and how do we build a new kind of economic and social order which enables the best parts of that system to thrive, and all of us to increase our standard of living and to build a better society. In what I want to talk about today is if companies, if industrial companies, if great corporations stood at the very heart and soul, at the center axis of the old industrial order, and those companies brought together physical assets, natural resources, they accumulated capital, they brought together physical workers, they accumulated great plots of land. They matched what economists call those great factors of production, land, labor, and capital. I think today the nature of the basic social and economic organizing unit of capitalism has shifted to some degree. Industrial companies, great industrial companies, still remain fundamentally important. But I think the city itself, the city and the metropolitan area, these great conglomerations of people and business and firms and hubs of activity, I would submit to you that what makes our work so important today is that the city itself has become the fundamental economic and social organizing unit of this new age of knowledge-based capitalism. We've been through these kinds of economic transformations and resets before. The one thing that I want you all to know is that these are not short-term adjustments. In the book that I just finished that was just published in Germany called The Reset, in English, The Great Reset, in Germany, The Reset, I talk about the time that it takes to move through these crisis and transformative periods. And these are generational events. They begin quite slowly, and I think right now people want to hold on to the old order, certainly in the United States, and I think what cost Mr. Obama so much political ground in the last election has been this attempt to bring back to life the fundamentals of the old housing order, the old financial order, the old economic order. But as these times progress over the course of 5 or 6 or 7 years, we begin to see periods of fundamental innovation and a resetting of the way people live and work and consume. And it's not a top-down process. It's not imposed by government policy or central bank affairs, although that may make a difference. It's really the accumulation of many shifts at the individual level, bottom up, as people go about building different kinds of lives. So we're very early on in this shift. We're only 2 or 3 years into it. But I think some of the fundamental trends of the new order come into view. Now, what lies at the bottom of this new kind of capitalism? What is its most fundamental characteristic? And here, lots of people have speculated. And many of those speculations have been important and shed light on critical aspects of this transformation, and many of them have influenced my own work. People have talked about the shift from an industrial to a post-industrial age, from a manufacturing to a service economy, from a simple system of making things to a new information society, post-industrial capitalism, high technology, internet, a new economy. And then, and I think, in the most pioneering theory of all, the great Peter Drucker, the late Peter Drucker, argued that capitalism was shifting to a new and fundamentally different system, which saw knowledge as the fundamental characteristic, the fundamental element of creating productivity, wealth, and value. In developing my own theories, I took all of these ideas and all of these theses into account. But when I looked at the problem, and when I was able to study the matter and travel the world and interview business leaders and working people and artists and technology and study high technology companies, and when I was able to begin to study fundamental human psychology, I came to the conclusion in synthesizing all of these works that there's a more fundamental element to this new kind of capitalism. And bear with me for 1 minute. When Marx long, long ago, more than 100 years ago, developed his theories of the transformation from feudalism to capitalism, he said that the key element of that new mode of production was that it harnessed, in a very effective way, a new kind of labor. It was able to harness on a mass scale, the physical labor of human beings. And he argued, and you will know this in his philosophical writings, that not only was this the key input to production, but what created a bond, a broader bond among humanity, and in his words, made, rightly or wrongly, made the proletariat a universal class, was the shared physical labor that we all used in factories to produce all the things that we use, from cars to steel. It was this, what he called, intersubjective nature of production, harnessing our physical labor. We needed to work together to produce things together, to build society, and we were alienated or exploited. That was the fundamental characteristic of being not only economic production, but of being a human being. Well, what is the fundamental characteristic that we truly all share? Is it the information we create? Is it the technologies that we develop? Is it the information or knowledge that is poured into our heads? No, those are all products of human endeavor. The thing that's even more important and more fundamental than human physical labor is the thing we see in our children. A little baby boy, a little baby girl, We see it in our nieces and nephews. We see it in children on the playground. We see it in when we're in school. We see it amongst our colleagues at work. We see it in great artists, great entrepreneurs, great business builders, great musicians. The fundamental source of human labor isn't just our physical labor. The most innate characteristic of human beings aren't our ability to produce things with our hands, although that's important. It's the product of the human mind. It's our human creativity, and psychologists who study human development will tell you the most fundamental distinguishing characteristics of human beings is our ability to engage in creative acts. So that's why I thought it was important to think about our new economic system, yes, as a knowledge system, yes, as an information system, yes, as a technology system, but at bottom of all those things, a system which fundamentally harnesses creativity. We're still early on in this system. It is not fully formed. We all know that it doesn't completely harness effectively human creativity. But more and more and more, we can see that the products that we invent, the products that we build our new industries around, and the transformations, what Joseph Schumpeter called the creative destruction of existing industries, are premised upon the harnessing of human creativity. Now, I just want to give you a few numbers to show you the depth and significance of this shift. At the turn of the last century, in the year 1900, more than half of all Germans, half of all Americans, still worked in the old agricultural order. A growing number of us were shifting to the new factory system, to manufacturing-based capitalism. Less than 5% of all of us worked in the sectors of the creative economy. Science, technology, innovation, entrepreneurship, research and development, education, healthcare, business, management, law, and the rest. By the year 1950, we had become an industrialized economy in that great post-war boom era. Now more than 50% of us worked in or around the blue-collar factory economy in great cities like Munich and Stuttgart, Pittsburgh and Cleveland, Detroit, in all the economic powerhouses of that time. Fewer and fewer of us worked in agriculture. It was 5% then. It's now 1% now, although we still produce a great amount of food. Less than 10% of us in the creative economy. Between 1980 and today, our economy has undergone an economic tsunami. Now, in the United States, 33% of the workforce is now employed in the creative sector of the economy, just 10%. Just 10% of Americans are employed in direct production factory occupations. In Germany, as you know, you have one of the highest percentages, along with the Scandinavian and Nordic countries, of the entire world, of the percentage of your own population and workforce that is employed in this creative sector of the economy. The statistics I have, which are a couple of years old, and this will have increased, more than 40% of all Germans, including the East, are now employed in the creative sector of the economy, certainly more than double, perhaps triple or fourfold the number that are employed in direct production operations in factories. When we look at the statistics, we are projecting in the United States another 10 million jobs to be created in the creative sector of the economy over the coming decade as manufacturing, tragically, falls further and further behind. That doesn't mean manufacturing will go away. It means that we will produce much more effectively and efficiently with fewer workers and more technology and better management. But what's so interesting, especially for all of you when you look at the crisis unfold outside of Germany, particularly in North America, at a time when unemployment in the United States was more than 10% overall, more than 15% in manufacturing. In Detroit, the mayor has concluded that the real rate of unemployment is more than 50%. At a time when unemployment in construction trades was 25% across the board, the rate of unemployment in the creative economy has never topped 5%. This is the growth force of our time, like it or not. This is where our economy is heading. It's an economy which makes things, which produces cars and manufactured products, which produces agriculture, but where human creativity, where human intellect and brain power become the primary force of production. Of course, that's true in the creation of new electronic and information technology. Of course, that's true in green tech and biotechnology. Of course, that's true in the new energy-efficient sectors of the economy. Of course, that's true in the multimedia world. But it's equally true in the manufacturing system. The companies that are showing their prowess, like BMW and many others, are showing their ability to enhance and utilize and harness the creativity of their design studios, their researchers, their technologists, and their factory workers. And I would submit to you, we are seeing a creative revolution in agriculture as well. The movement to organics, to upvalue products, to imbuing everything from the wines we and the beers we drink to cheeses and meats, and a whole revolution in the agricultural food chain that my colleagues and I have been studying, a movement from a simple commodity business to increasing value through the application of creativity, broad-based creative destruction and remaking and transformation of our economy around creativity. Now, as you know, my theories have not been without their critics. And I think it's very important for you to realize that I learn a tremendous amount from my critics. As an academic and a scholar, I welcome criticism, even when it's personally painful. I welcome it, I think about it, and I find that it opens my mind and I learn from it. One set of critics I find have been quite humorous, mainly in the United States, mainly amongst people you would think of as Tea Party or social conservatives. They've criticized my views on the grounds of diversity and social tolerance. They've poked fun at the fact that I have found in my work that tolerance matters. They don't like the idea that communities that are open to gays and lesbian or artistic and cultural creatives or to new immigrants and foreign-born people, they reject that idea because they don't believe it is important to economic growth. Those critics are easy to dismiss. But if you want, we can talk about them in the Q&A. But another group of critics I find more interesting. And I think they've hit on something that it lies in the nature of our very economic system. Those critics look at the rise of this new creative economy and say it divides people. It divides people increasingly by class. It creates haves and have-not people, and I would submit to you, creates haves and have-not cities. And they point at the rise of the creative economy, and they say, what Florida is talking about is a creative elite. Now, I want to tell you that that's not exactly right. Even though the forces that are at work are dividing us, I hope you will understand my theory and the theory of the creative economic revolution as a theory that was developed particularly to show the potential progressive nature and inclusive nature of this transformation. And I believe this is our challenge. This is our challenge in Munich. This is our challenge in Germany. This is our challenge throughout the world. To extend and expand the boundaries of the creative economy, we're never going to be able to build a stable economy on 30 or 35 or 40% of the workforce. We just saw the results of this in the United States, where the Republicans of the Tea Party were swept into victory by working people who were angered at the unevenness and spikiness of our time. A creative economy to work has to become a truly creative society and one that is inclusive. And I need to tell you where my ideas come from. My ideas come not from studying arts communities or multicultural districts, or bohemian quarters, or gay enclaves. My ideas originated from studying factories. In the 1980s, I was challenged when I saw the decline of the big three factories and the rise first of Japanese factories in the American Midwest, and later German factories like the BMW and Mercedes, Bosch and others, in the heartland and into the Sun Belt. I developed a large-scale project to study the transformation of manufacturing industry and its globalization. I studied all of America's factories, and as some of you may remember, I toured all of Germany's factories and throughout Europe. I went to Japan and to Asia, and in Japan, I got a life lesson. I met the plant manager of one of the greatest Japanese auto factories in the mid-1980s, and he said something which sticks in my mind. He said, we're going to beat the big three. And the reason isn't American workers, it's American management. You see the key to success in the head of the CEO, in the research and development lab, and in the great MBAs. And I say that as someone who teaches in a business school. We know better. We see the key to success in tapping and harnessing the collective intelligence and capability of each and every worker on the factory floor. The Japanese called it Kaizen, or continuous improvement. German companies understood this intuitively, and the best American companies responded. But the key to success lying in harnessing the collective intelligence of those workers working together in teams to provide a continuous stream of innovation, product and process upgrading. I learned about this when I was a little boy from my own father. My father was born during the Great Depression. He took up work in a factory, an eyeglass factory, at age 13. My dad worked in that factory from age 13, one job for life, till age 65, making eyeglasses. When I was a young boy, I wanted to see where my father worked, and I would beg him to take me to the factory. He said, Richard, I work in the factory so you can get an education. It's your job to go to school and better yourself. But on Saturdays, when the plant was running overtime, he would relent. And we'd take a drive to that giant brick factory in Newark, New Jersey, the great industrial district of Newark. And I would enter the factory, and I would see the machines going, making the wire frames, extruding the plastic frames, a cauldron of Italian-Americans, German-Americans working the machine tools, Portuguese-Americans, Hispanic and Latino. My father would see me looking at the machines and watching them make these eyeglass parts, and he'd say to me, Richard, it's not the machines that matter. It's not technology that's the key. It's the knowledge, it's the intelligence, it's the creativity of the people who work here. You see, that's the key element. The key element is how do we harness that creativity that lies deep within all of us? And that's where my theory of diversity comes from. That's why I developed a theory that said diversity is so important. You see, the places that win and the companies that win are the ones that can harness the creativity of the broadest number of people. Creativity does not respect the social categories of gender, race, ethnicity, and sexual orientation that we have imposed on ourselves. Creativity cuts across, it levels. I think the greatest challenge of our time is to build a system that can include the creativity of each and all. That won't be easy. That will be very hard in a society that is dividing. Dividing by educational attainment, dividing by the kinds of work to do, dividing by the kinds of places we live. And I see that in the United States. You may believe you're immune in Germany. You're not. When we moved to Toronto in Canada 3 years ago, I thought Toronto and Canada were immune from these forces. I can tell you it's not. When we studied the character of Toronto and Montreal and Vancouver, we saw the same fundamental divide, the same fundamental sorting of those of us who have advantage and education moving up and working people, and worse than that, people who toil in the service economy, who take care of our children and our aging parents, who take care of our homes, who sell us our meals and our food, who help us with our clothes and buy our clothing, falling further and further behind. One of the greatest challenges of our time is to upgrade those service jobs. My dad told me a story. When he took his job in 1934 in the factory, it took 9 people to make a living family wage. 9 people. When he came back after the war, he had a good job with high pay. He could buy a house and put his 2 boys through school. In the United States, with the union movement, but more so in Germany, with your own experiment in social democracy, we made factory work good jobs. They were not preordained good jobs. Marx told us about, and William Blake told us about, the work in the satanic mills. In Germany, in Northern Europe, in the United States, we elevated the work of factory workers. We have to do the same today with every worker. Not by artificially inflating wages, not by social welfare that demotivates people, but a new kind of social compact, which harnesses the creativity and initiative and full talent which creates a basic economic right for each and every individual to cultivate those talents, to invest in those talents, and then to harness those talents and to use them as a source of innovation and continuous improvement like BMW does, and like the great manufacturing companies do with their workers on the factory floor. Now, that brings me to my second point. In an age of knowledge, in an age of technology, in the age of the internet, many of us believe that globalization is making place less important, that geography is no longer critical, and that, in the words of Tom Friedman, the world is flat. But there's a powerful counterforce. There's a powerful counterforce. While simple activity spreads, and while much of simple manufacturing moves to China, the world's factory, there is a powerful counterforce that mitigates against the extreme effects of decentralization and disaggregation. It's the effect of the clustering force and the power of concentration of people and ideas. It's the rise and continued growth of our great cities. You know, countervailing globalization is this curious fact. Last year was a historic year in all of human civilization. It was the first year in all of mankind that more than 50% of us live in cities, according to the United Nations. According to my own work, when I identified the great 40 mega regions of the world, the real economic centers, the Boston, New York, Washington corridor, the area from Frankfurt to Stuttgart, the Beijing-Shanghai axis, the Mumbai-Bangalore corridor, these greater Tokyo, the Amsterdam, the Antwerp area, these great conglomerations, 40 of these great mega regions are the real economic units of our time. They house 1 in 5 of our people, but produce 2/3 of our economic output and 9 in 10 of our innovations. Why? Why do we have the concentration of core economic assets, 9 in 10 of our innovations, our research and development, our centers of creativity and technological excellence? Why are they compacting themselves rather than spreading apart? The great Jane Jacobs gave us an answer. She said more than 40 years ago that she believed she had discovered what really creates economic growth and development. And Robert Lucas, when he won the Nobel Prize, said, indeed, in his opinion, she had. What she figured out is that industrial corporations and the theories of Adam Smith are very good at increasing the division of labor. They make economic activity more and more specialized. They enable us to produce more efficiently. But they do not necessarily invent. And it's harder for industrial corporations to create whole new things and whole new industries. Those, she argued, come not from companies, but from cities. Cities, she said, are the places that real innovation springs forth. Why? Because they collect a diversity of people, a diversity of thinking styles, a diversity of companies which can combine and recombine and build something new. Cities create leverage, real leverage. Leverage for all of us, they make us more productive, and leverage through increasing innovation. The best example of that, although there are many, is Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley has emerged as the world's leading center of technology because it brings together not the best and brightest from California, not the best and brightest from the United States, not the best and brightest from North America, but the best and brightest from the world. And it concentrates them in one place where they continuously can combine and recombine and make something new. I would argue to you that in our time, cities and their metropolitan hinterlands have become the central, the key, the fundamental economic and social organizing force of our time, bringing together capital and labor, mental labor and creativity, bringing together talent and technology in ways that make them the core element of harnessing real capital, building a new real economy, and charting a way to a new economic system of wealth, productivity, and sustained and shared prosperity. Let me just spend a couple of minutes, talking about what are the key dimensions of cities and places and how we can begin to better understand them. In my book, Rise of the Creative Class, I offered a simple theory of the three keys of economic development. I offered that theory because so many people in economic development believe that the key to economic growth lied in two things, company attraction and company retention, and in the building only of technology superclusters. Both are critically important. But looking at the situation in Pittsburgh, where I was living, and many other cities, I began to see that there were other dimensions that matter. I call them the three T's: technology, talent, and tolerance. Technology is important. It's critical. It's the first T. But technology can move. I witnessed that in Pittsburgh when the companies and technologies that were invented at Carnegie Mellon moved away. Talent is key. Great school systems, great universities, the ability to develop people and invest in human potential. But people can and do move. And so talent is a mobile factor of production. It's not a stock. It's a flow. And the third T is important: tolerance, openness, inclusiveness, diversity, because it enables areas and cities and regions to attract technology and to attract talent from many places in the world. Again, Silicon Valley. More than 50% of the new startup businesses founded in Silicon Valley over the past two decades were founded by a new immigrant from India or China or Germany or Europe to that region. The three T's are critical, and there's a fourth T. I just want to spend a couple of minutes on it. We call it territorial assets. It is the unique, authentic conditions of a place. It's the history, the cultural institutions, the natural environment, the intersection of the natural and built environment that creates the real underlying texture of the city. You can't document it with statistics, or it's very difficult to document with statistics, but you can feel it in a place. It gives a place its true character. With the Gallup organization, we were able to study tens of thousands of people in the United States, in Europe, and across the world, and to ask them what matters to them in their lives. And here's what I find so interesting. Cities are critically important for our economic momentum forward. The stronger our cities, the more vibrant our cities, the denser they become, the more energy efficient they become, the stronger our economy becomes. But they're even more important than that. They are a core part of our human identity and a critical part of our ability to live satisfying and fulfilling lives. We asked with Gallup, what are the key things that make your life fulfilled and satisfied? We got three answers. The first two you will understand. Number one was the ability to engage in fulfilling work, fulfilling and challenging work that makes a difference and creates meaning and purpose. That was much more important than just simply income. The second was having social ties, social relationships, loving family, friends, relatives, a community that allows you to be yourself and to live the life and raise the family you want. But the third was quite surprising and has never been probed before. The third was, the third source of a triangle of human fulfillment and meaning was the community we live in. Tens of thousands of people told us that they get meaning and purpose in their life, not just from doing challenging work and having meaningful social ties, but living in a community which reflects their interests, in which they feel a member and can express themselves. So our next step was to look in detail at the characteristics of a community that's not just economically successful, that creates fulfillment and purpose and meaning. And I think that nexus of economic achievement and personal fulfillment and meaning is the true nexus of our time. What we found is that there was a pyramid of a great, meaningful, purposeful community. At the bottom was basic security and safety. At the next level was economic opportunity. But at the top were two things: the ability to express yourself and live in a diverse community, and a community that was aesthetically meaningful, that protected its natural environment, that invested in its history, that invested in its culture, and that kept a sense of itself. I think that's the challenge of our time, to make sure we create meaningful and purposeful work, to stoke and help our economy to recover, and to build places that can truly resonate with people and help us achieve a new era of economic renewal. And I look forward to your questions.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Richard, for your inspiring speech. There's one question that immediately comes to my mind in the light of the, well, recent developments in the U.S., the Barack Obama disaster two days ago. There's one thing I can recall. It's a book as groundbreaking as The Rise of the Creative Class, issued by MIT Press at the beginning of the 90s, The Second Revolution in the Automotive Industry, which exactly showed these principles of Kaizen, continuous improvement. And at exactly the same time, a U.S. minister said the problem with the Germans is that they built beautiful products, cars mainly, but unfortunately last decade or last century products. Standing here at the BMW World, meanwhile, the largest premium car manufacturer in the world, the second largest being Mercedes, the third being Audi, obviously something went right here in this society. What went wrong in the U.S. with the manufacturing industry?
Well, at the same time, you know that book influenced me a lot. I was part of that team. I actually wrote a book at that same time in 1990 called The Breakthrough Illusion, Why America Makes the Breakthroughs and Does Not Follow Through. And a colleague of mine, Mr. Henry Ergus, who many of the audience will be familiar with, had a very interesting theory. He said that if you took the U.S. and Germany and compared them, the U.S. had an economic system or innovation system that was very good at shifting to new technology, but abandoning the old, causing massive deindustrialization and disruption. He said that Germany, and I think he was partly right, had a system of deepening. It could take existing industries from steel to chemistry to automotive, add worker innovation and design innovation and research innovation, and deepen them and make them the best in the world. And then he challenged both of us. He said, what we really need is a system that can shift and deepen. And I think that's our joint challenge. From a societal point of view, the U.S. system looked very good 10 years ago when it was creating a Google and even longer Apple and new financial instruments. But it created enormous economic crisis. The German system today looks phenomenal because it has deepened and has less social disruption. But I think this is a challenge. And I think this is the application of creativity throughout our entire system. How do we apply creativity at the high end, in the research, in the technology, in the new innovation? But how do we also apply it in the basics, from manufacturing to agriculture? And I think this is something we have to learn together, and this is something we have to do together. It's interesting, no individual country has the answer, but they have parts. And the other thing about BMW that I'll just say to you, I was very happy, and I'm happy to be with you, because BMW said that it had the market to my creative class. So I was particularly happy that BMW was a far-sighted company in making a great car, but also understanding that marketing the car, and I think other companies have picked up on this, the Smart, the Audi, that to market the car to the particular locations of the creative class was a very good way to get your car and new product adopted quickly.
I think you're absolutely right. There is, let's say, one epitomal car in Germany for parts of the creative class, which is definitely the Mini, which is the car for the wealthy urban inhabitant, mainly female. So obviously BMW learned a lot from the creative class thinking. Well, coming back to the rise of creative class almost, 10 or 8 years ago when you published this, I would say, groundbreaking book. I think the last 8 years must have been extremely exciting for you, just being, so to say, the global superstar in city development. Looking back at what you wrote down in the Rise of Creative Class and the books later on and earlier on, what has come true and what would you see differently today?
Well, first of all, I think I'd written 4 or 5 books before in many papers and no one paid attention to me. And I think what made the book successful is that I tried to tell the truth. I broke with existing theories, even though people thought I was a little crazy, is that I tried to look with my eyes at cities of Germany and cities of Asia, cities of the U.S. and North America and say, looking at the street, what do I think is really motivating? And I tried to talk less to academic scholars and more from my heart, not only to real people, but more from my heart. And I was really arguing with my field and what I thought were some of the not incorrect, but limited theories. And I think somehow that resonated, and I was very fortunate. I think the things that I've learned is that creativity is more important than I thought. that as the past 8 or 10 years have occurred, this shift to creativity is a source of wealth and production, but not just in the high tech and in the entertainment, in the multimedia, in the convergent sectors, but on the factory floor and especially on the farm. I think that's number one. Number two, I've learned that our economy is becoming incredibly dividing and spiky. I would have never imagined 10 years ago that that the economic divides that I saw could become this pronounced, and could become pronounced in cities that I thought were models, like my very own Toronto, which the city is completely segmented, creative economy or high human capital versus service workers and lower levels of education. I think the economic divides in our society between countries, within countries, in China, between, as my student said, he said, Professor Florida, I live in Shanghai. And he said, with all respect, I have a better life than you do. And a young man, he said, but the people who live on the outskirts of Shanghai live in pre-civilized conditions. The divides within cities that we see in New York or San Francisco or Washington, D.C., and many, or London, the divides within cities, as returns to creativity grow, our societies get yanked apart. I think that's the most fundamental challenge of our time, and I don't think our political leaders are looking at it. I think restoring social cohesion and political cohesion and avoiding the outcome that happened in the U.S. with the election means we have to bring the bottom of society up, and we have to create a new generation of new jobs. So one of my new projects is on the service workers. How do we take the 50%, the 45 to 50% of our labor force that toils in low-wage work that most people think is simple work and can't be approved, how do we apply the principles of creativity and lean production, which you just mentioned, to making the service work? How do we create a new social compact, really? A new social compact which values human beings in all of our towns and lets everyone participate in this explosive, transformative, and disruptive creative age.
Two questions regarding that. Well, as you know, I work in a strategy consulting firm. We have carried out a couple of projects on that. And the first thing I see when I talk to mayors, for example, is that they have some kind of vague interpretation of the word creativity. In many cases, they basically refer to what we would call the super creative core, being the artist and being everything around, but not what we would call the creative worker or people being creative in the creative class. And the second thing I see there is this gentrification point, which is a common criticism to your theory, is something which is kind of enforced by what is done in creative class strategies in cities, because mayors or public administrations focus on, let's say, the more attractive parts of the society, the more creative, the better educated people. What do you think? Can this be changed?
We're in a continuous process of education and learning. That's what the rise of every new era does. And I think for mayors, it's easy. It makes perfect sense that a mayor would gravitate. So many mayors I like and admire would gravitate to investing in creativity. It makes more sense than building a giant stadium and spending billions of dollars in a convention center in the United States on a casino. And by focusing on creativity, they can do small things that seem to pay a difference. So it makes perfect sense. But of course, we have to broaden the discussion. We have to understand that those simple things may help at the margin, but they won't build a robust and cohesive city. I'm telling you, I saw this in Toronto, where Toronto has just elected a very far right-wing mayor. It was the city of creativity, the city of investing in creativity. And this goes to your point of gentrification. Gentrification isn't the end. Gentrification is the product of the creative economy. It's not real estate developers doing this, and it's not a mayor investing in an arts district, or it's not artistic people concentrating themselves. People are concentrating based on a basic economic logic that says that densely concentrated areas increase productivity. This isn't about artists and cultural creatives. This is about the very logic of capitalism, pushing people together along transit lines and towards the core, because it saves time, it creates efficiency, and it increases productivity and innovation. We can't stop that. So what we have to do is develop coping mechanisms. And what we see now is a backlash. We see it all over the world as people are saying, I don't want to be disrooted. My father's house was mowed down to make way for for a highway. I don't want to be disrooted. My community is too valuable. I want to live near the core. This will take a much deeper thinking, not only on the part of mayors, but on the part of national leaders. And I would ask you, what national leader in the world is beginning to this is what we need a global conversation on. A global conversation about how to harness these creative forces that are sorting us into has and have-nots, and how do we spread them? We're tinkering at the margins with the most powerful economic force in human history when we need a broader approach to be inclusive and to figure out a mechanism that all can participate in and locate in the creative economy. But without this, gentrification will continue, concentration will continue, divides will continue, and we're going to have a cycle of political backlash, anger, and rage.
You were talking about the challenges for cities and especially their mayors. What we could see from our research here in Germany, when you, for example, compare Munich, where we are right now, and Hamburg, where I live, and looking at the, let's say, population structures, let's say from a bird's eye view, they might look pretty similar. But when you look at the values profiles, for example, of the people living in Hamburg and the people in Munich, they are almost opposite. The people in Munich are more prestige-oriented, less quality-oriented. They like to spend a lot of money. They're basic hedonistic. People in Hamburg are way more conservative, more quality-oriented. This is research. This is research. There's a strong fraction from Hamburg here, obviously. But what I want to say is, looking at the specifics of the city, and there are obviously many more different kinds of cities, and Hamburg and Munich are somewhat similar. If you compare Shanghai with London or Bangalore with Toronto, it's way more different. What does that mean? Is there a, let's say, ideal composition of creative people, of creativity with regard to a certain industry structure, for example?
Yeah, I think the task of our time is to value each and every human being as creative. We certainly know which elements within the occupational structure, within creative occupational structures, add more economic value. I'm hesitant to even say this, but we know this empirically. Scientists and technologists, business managers, and artists, designers, and cultural creatives are the real value adders. The others are important, but they're the real things that add particular distinguishing value add to your regional economy. With regard to Hamburg and with regard to Toronto, Munich, and what makes us all the same, it's very interesting looking at Hamburg particularly and comparing it to where I live, Toronto, which I think are very creative cities, very authentic cities, have made a lot of efforts to be inclusive with the arts community. As in Hamburg, our arts and cultural community, who are my friends, had a giant, I will call it, temper tantrum and started yelling and screaming at a mayor who's a left-wing, quasi-socialist mayor who loves them and has done everything to improve their condition, and they started to complain about gentrification, and they complained about the condos. You know what happened? Most people who are working people and are toiling people, they saw those artists the same way they look at me or you or the audience. They saw all of us as one giant gentrifying, upscale mass of people. And they elected an uber right-wing mayor from the suburbs to shut it down. They don't care about creativity. They don't want any funding for the arts. They want the art district mowed down. They want, you know, better roadways, less taxes. If this creative class doesn't get its act together, and I said this in Rise of the Creative Class, grow up. If we do not grow up together, artists and cultural creatives and designers and techies and business managers, do you know what's out there? How strong the forces of reaction are at work in our society? Do you remember what happened in the previous periods of economic transportation? These temper tantrums have to stop. And people have to get on with the business of building a really cohesive, progressive society that says we all have creativity to offer. And it's not just about my artistic creativity or my intellectual creativity or my technology company. It's about building a society which includes everyone. We have to look beyond ourselves and our little neighborhoods and build a fully functioning society which rewards everyone, especially the people at the bottom. Because when they look up, they don't see a difference between an artist, a designer, a banker, a businessman, a policy, or an intellectual. They see one class, an upscale creative class. That is the biggest challenge, and the onus there belongs with all of us as a unified creative class. So I would hope and pray that this time in our period, when we see the forces of reaction mounting, when I'm saying reaction, I mean real backward-looking reaction, We can all get together, artists and every one of us in the creative class, put aside our differences and build something for a better future, not just for us, but for all in society. I think that's the number one challenge of our time.
Richard, since, well, almost every city I know is thinking about working on a creative class or talent strategy here in Germany and well, Europe-wide, basically, how is there a way to distinguish or to differentiate from each other? I mean, when you look at the Midwest in the U.S., and I think we as Germans or Europeans can say that, let's say reanimating a river walk and having some nice apartment blocks is what a typical U.S. mayor perceives as a, let's say, urbanization. Coming from a European background where the typical Italian piazza is something where we were raised on, basically, we are a bit more sophisticated, I guess, with that. Looking at this extreme intensity of competition here with cities in Europe, an extremely densely populated area, is there a way to differentiate in terms of talent attraction, talent retention?
So your questions are phenomenal. And this interchange between what you do in developing strategy and my own idea generation, I think, is a wonderful. I would love that we could do this more. So I'm going to address this on two levels. The first level is with regard to the creative class. And I think for mayors and economic development strategists and talent strategists, the idea of the creative class was always that it could be everyone. So I think developing strategies which harness the creativity of everyone, not just a specific group, should be the underpinning. Not because I think that can get us away from the divides that are getting worse and worse, and especially focusing on the hidden creative class or the hidden creative elements, deeply embedded among new communities, immigrant communities, working communities, farming communities, and making an effort to highlight those as well as the urban, more upscale creativity. I think that's one thing that we have to do, which brings me to the second point, differentiation. Every community is unique. And this was the core message in the sections on not quality of life, the quality of place, and in this fourth T of territorial asset. Every community is unique, and too much of what has been done in economic development has been to make the community generic. Even more so with the rise of global brands. And you are saying the Mini being the car of the young creative class and maybe woman, not just in Germany, in the United States, in Canada, all over the world, are, in fact, many of the things we consume, our clothing, the goods we put in our homes, even the coffee. I drink Italian coffee. All the coffee we drink, the foods we eat are becoming more homogeneous and in many ways generic. So for the place we live in, if we want it to be substantive, if we want it to be unique, we have to build which is on authentic and real. And there, I think there are two things that we need to focus on, in addition to workforce and clustering and jobs. One is the built environment. And I think Europe has done this so much better than North America. But protecting and preserving and reusing our built environment in new ways, making it new. And in the U.S., sometimes we preserve in amber, like a colonial town. No, using it in a new way and building on it. The second one is the natural environment and the intersection of the built and the natural. When we ask people what they really love in cities, we got back green space, parks, fresh air, clean water, the ability to make sure we have a green. And the silly example is the High Line Park in New York. But you could look in New York at that strip of bike lane that goes along the river on the west side. It changes the whole complexion. So I think this integration of greening and the built environment and really focusing on what's unique, staying away from the generic strategy, staying away from the copycat, doing something, and I think the key there is to ask the people. If I had one advice for mayor and counselor and economic developer, it's to make sure the people are really included in the development of those ideas and can provide perspective, because oftentimes they have unique perspectives and important perspectives on how to make a community that they feel fulfilled and purposeful and satisfied in.
Yeah, I think you know our nice example from Stuttgart now about urban development and people's participation. So I think we're all pretty aware of that right now. What we could see is, and this is a kind of interesting phenomenon, we're mainly we're working for the private industries, and everybody tells us that talent is a scarce resource and that we are facing the war for talent, as it was called by McKinsey 15 years ago. And the cities are talking about talent retention, talent generation as well. But if it then comes to the point that you ask companies to be incorporated into these activities, in many cases they don't understand what they have to do with the cities they're in. This is something we at least see here in Germany, that there's like some kind of glass ceiling or invisible border between the public and the private sector in working together on these things. What are your experiences on that?
Well, first of all, I think we have to get away from the idea that talent is a zero sum. I understand where that comes from, especially as an American, where 75% of our PhD computer scientists come from outside the U.S. 50% of our business founders in Silicon Valley come from outside the U.S. Why? Because we haven't developed our people. So I think we should see talent not as a zero sum, but as a limitless resource, and we have to make those investments across the board early on, and we have to give people the ability to develop their talents, and I think that's key. With regard to companies, this is what my course is on. My course this term is on a locational strategy for company, multinational company, but also a community prosperity strategy. We're finding exactly what you find, that so many companies may understand when they depend on a certain area for talent or for inputs, but they have a lot of trouble understanding how to invest in a community. I think the best we've been able to do is look for some best practices. Two that we can find in North America are the SAS Institute in the North Carolina, where the founder did not relocate to Silicon Valley, but he built a wonderful campus. He keeps a low turnover, but he also makes massive investments in the artistic, the open space, the environmental conditions of Raleigh-Durham, massive investments, to make that a more exciting place for its residents and to attract people. The other one is RIM. I saw many of you with the BlackBerry in the audience before, not when I was speaking, of course, but before I was speaking. And they're located in Waterloo, Canada. This is a very small town outside of Toronto, but a great university. The founders there, who are Greeks, Greek Canadians, are undertaking to invest in the university, to build a major physics institute, to build sports activities, and to improve the downtown. But they see themselves as part of the community. We have a term for this, by the way, for company people. My dean and I coined a term. We call it not competitive advantage, a la the great scholar Michael Porter, jurisdictional advantage. For a company, the place you locate not only creates a competitive advantage, it creates a jurisdictional advantage by enabling the attraction of talent, by enabling people to feel purposeful in their lives, by the creation of all sorts of inputs. And I think for companies, thinking beyond the border and understanding how to act strategically to build jurisdictional advantage is key. And it's something we're actively working on and would love to work on more with you.
Okay, I think we need these lectures here in Europe as well. We should invite you. I think there are some university people around here. So, it's not only about development. It's also about, let's say, the classical marketing things. Well, European cities spend millions on marketing each other against themselves against each other. Are there any specific and effective ways of marketing cities, of making them more attractive to the outside world and also to the inhabitants?
Here I have to be a little tough. And when I wrote Rise of the Creative Class, I remember asking young people and creative class people about city branding strategies. And they said they didn't like it, like they didn't like to be marketed at in a very strong way with the city. They thought city branding strategies that they saw were old school. And they said that's like when they go for an interview with a company they want to work for, some companies send a younger person who looks like them, who dresses like them, and they resonate with. Some people send somebody who looks like me, older, less resonant with them, and they just can't get it. So I think for cities, they have to be much more subtle in the way that they express themselves and communicate themselves, much less top branding, and much more subtle and viral. And one of the things we found in all marketing, we've been looking at this, all marketing increasingly is not just a demographic segment, it's a locational segment. And within a city has different segments, and not to show maybe one image, maybe to show the many faces of that city that resonate with different groups of people because we're so different. Even though some things are the same, so many things are so different. So what in marketing places, focusing much more on the authentic and the real, the historical, not making a broad, over-encompassing statement, and making sure that the different faces of that community can be shown. I think those are all critical things, but I think cities have to be very careful now to get out there too far with a heavy-handed, top-down branding strategy, a little bit more subtle, a little bit more viral, a little bit more organic, and neighborhood-based, I think could pay dividends. And it's at least something we should try in communicating who we are as a city to our people and to people around the world.
I think you're aware of this Not in Our Name initiative in Hamburg, where exactly this happens, that the creative people of the city didn't want to be incorporated in the overall top-down city branding strategy, which is basically the core of what you said. Well, I actually love to continue this for hours, but since we're running out of time and the studio is only booked until half past the hour, which I've learned from the organizers, I would like to finish with the last question. What comes next in what you're doing and what we have to expect?
Well, first, I will give you the bad news, and then I'll give you the good news. My idol and mentor is Jane Jacobs. What is the last book Jane Jacobs wrote before she died? Dark Age Ahead. I think we have a choice. We can pick a progressive future which harnesses the creativity of everyone, and we can actively, as members of the creative class who have great good fortune, lead, or we can let history take its course. My hunch is we have a decade or two of hard work ahead of us, but if we invest in the creativity of all, if we build a social compact and social structure which harnesses the creativity of all, we can lead the way to a better society. But it's going to take time, there's going to be setbacks, and we're just going to have to stay steadfast. I want to thank you all for listening, for your great questions, for your interaction. If you want to contact me, Florida@creativeclass.com, and I hope to see you in person in the not-too-distant future. Thanks again.